Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I am going to cover Psalms 127. I will entitle the psalm, Unless the Lord Builds the House, They Labor in Vain Who Build It. The heading of this psalm is A Song of Ascents of Solomon. That's Ascents, A-S-C-E-N-T-S, going up, A Song of Ascents of Solomon. So we know that Solomon wrote this psalm, assuming the heading is accurate, and I do that. I always assume that the heading is accurate, although it is not necessarily inspired by the Holy Spirit. Now, what does ascents mean? Here are four options given by the NIV Study Bible. Option number one, ascents refers to the music that was played with this psalm, and that music went up in pitch. It ascended in pitch. I'm not impressed by that option. Option number two, the ascents could refer to the steps of the Jews returning from captivity, because as they came back from Babylon, they went up to Jerusalem. They ascended to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was on a hill. And that's reasonable to me. Here's option number three. The psalm was sung as a song by the Levitical singers as they walked up the steps of the temple doing their temple worship duties. That's reasonable to me, too. And option number four is also reasonable. This option is asserted by Adam Clark and gotquestions.org. This option says that ascents refers to the steps of a pilgrim coming up to Jerusalem as he comes up for the three Levitical priests that are required each year. The men had to go to Jerusalem three times a year, in the spring for Passover, in the summer for the Feast of Weeks, in the autumn for the Feast of Tabernacles, and as they came, they would have to be going up because Jerusalem's on a hill. And so the idea is that these pilgrims would be singing this psalm as well as the other psalms of ascent. That's my favorite option. Now, there are 15 psalms that have in the title a song of ascents, or in the heading. David was the author of four of them. 10 of them are anonymous, and Solomon is the author of one of them, and that's this one, Psalms 127. And by the way, Solomon is also credited with writing Psalm 72. So in the 150 Psalms, Solomon does two of them. He's written two of them. So we begin now by reading verses 1 through 2. Solomon begins this way. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved even in his sleep. In verse 1, Solomon says, unless the Lord builds the house, which house is he referring to? Here are four options. Option number one, Solomon's own house, you recall. The fabulous description of Solomon's temple, back in the book of Kings, 2 Kings, I believe, somewhere. Or it could refer to the house of the Lord, the temple. That also had a fabulous description. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown prefers that option. Option number three, unless the Lord builds the house of one's family, unless the Lord gives one a numerous offspring, as Adam Clark suggests. I don't think that's true, but that's what, I mean, I think it's true, but I don't think that's what Solomon is referring to here. We could drop down to verses 3 through 5, and we see Solomon is talking about children. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. That does sound like God is building a house in the sense of a family, a house, a family. But I don't think that's what it is, because the rest of the verse 1 is talking about a city. That's a physical thing. The house, if it is in parallel with the city, which it is, then the house would more likely be something physical. Now, option number 4, it could just refer to any house in general, not Solomon's house and not God's house, the temple. I'm going to say it's the temple because that makes such a good application when we get to the New Testament church, which is the New Testament temple of God. We want the New Testament temple of God to be splendid and fabulous, but it's not going to happen unless God does it, unless God builds the church. They labor in vain who build it, and that includes local expressions of the church. You want to build a church, you better not try to do it with your glib tongue and your organizational and managerial abilities. You better let the Lord build a house, otherwise you're wasting your time. You labor in vain. Now, referring to this laboring in vain, it is incredible to me how many people work all their lives and see their wealth squandered, either by them or by their descendants. I know the story of a wealthy businessman, somebody I knew personally. He's deceased now. And he told his children that he was doing all he could to spend all the money he had so they wouldn't get any of it. So he spent all of his life working as a businessman. He was a good businessman, very good businessman. For what? You can't take it with you when you go. And how about all the people who want to have children who carry on the family name and who are so concerned about the name of the family, as in the middle-aged aristocracy in Europe? The family name, the heritage, that was all that meant anything to those people. How many of them kept the family going? The Habsburgs are gone. The Wittelsbachs are gone. The Tudors are gone. They're all gone. They labored in vain to build their house. I think here in the southern part of the United States, we were always told that this person comes from good stock, good family. We need to carry on the family name. We're big about that in the South. And I look around and say, yeah, look at the family name. Look at the descendants of that great family. Alcoholic bums, drug addicts. So Solomon at the end of verse 1 says, unless the Lord guards the city. What city? Well, it could be any city in general, but I think he's probably referring to his city of Jerusalem. Unless the Lord guards Jerusalem, the watchman keeps awake in vain. Now, a watchman can be of help in guarding a city if there's a criminal or something wandering loose in the streets, but when there's a big disaster like a riot or some kind of a gang robbery or fire or something like that or an earthquake, what good is it to have a watchman? God has got to keep the city from all those disasters. A watchman can do nothing. It doesn't matter if he stays awake all night long. It's not going to stop fires, earthquake, floods, whatever, enemy attacks. In verse 2, Solomon says, it is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. That means to eat the bread that was produced by you by all of your hard work. You get up early, you go to bed late, you work all day. What's the point? This sounds a lot like the book of Ecclesiastes, which Solomon also wrote. Instead of doing that, working so hard in your flesh, Solomon says in the last part of verse 2, look, God gives to his beloved even in his sleep. When he's not working, when he's not getting up early, when he's not going to bed late, while he's sleeping, God will give him whatever he needs. And ladies and gentlemen, these two verses are great verses to counteract the universal tendency in human flesh to do it on our own without God helping us. Jesus said, apart from me, you can do nothing. Paul said, in my weakness, he will make me strong. Don't do anything in your flesh. Every young Christian should learn that, and every old Christian should be reminded of it constantly. Now, when Solomon says that God gives to his beloved, even in the beloved's sleep, we have a translation issue here. The KJV says, he giveth his beloved sleep. In other words, it's not that he's sleeping and God gives him something while he's sleeping. It's that he puts his beloved to sleep. The idea there being probably that his beloved, having worked all day, risen up early, retired late, he's worried. He's thinking about all the stuff that he had to do during the day. And God comes along and says, you don't need to worry about all that. Just go to bed. Go to sleep. That's one way to translate it. The NIV translates it the same way. He grants sleep to those he loves. The sleep is what is given by God to the beloved. But the NIV marginal note has this, for while they sleep, for while the beloved sleep, God provides for them. So it can be translated either way. We move now to Psalms 127, verses 3 through 5, and we will finish this psalm. Solomon continues, behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. Now this verse is a great antidote to the anti-children ethos that's in today's culture. Oh, we can't have children. We might put a strain on the environment. They never think that having a lot of children might be the means by which one of those children invents stuff to take care of the environment. That thought never crosses these thanatopic leftist minds. Children are a good thing, not a bad thing. Children take care of you when you get old. I lived in China for 23 years, and all I heard about was the one-child policy, the one-child policy. We've got too many people over here. And I was shocked near the end of my sojourn in China. All of a sudden, the government got rid of the one-child policy. The reason being was because there weren't enough young people to take care of old people. If a one-child man marries a one-child woman, they've got four parents. And that means there's only two kids to take care of the four parents. And all of a sudden, the social planners in communist China realized, we've got a big problem here. They've still got that problem. So now they're up to a two-child policy. Now, one might ask, why does Solomon all of a sudden, having talked about the house being built by the Lord and not by the vain labor of men, why does all of a sudden he start talking about children are a gift of the Lord? Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown speculates about that. He says that children are mentioned here because all of the aforementioned labor is commonly done for children. That might be a connection. Reminds me, I just heard a story about a Chinese woman driving a Porsche, living in a beautiful house. Her husband and her were both working morning to night. And she told the Chinese evangelist who was witnessing to her, she said, I don't have time. I want to be a Christian after my kid gets out of high school. But until then, I have to work morning to night to provide for him. And I told the aforesaid Chinese evangelist, I said, you know, materialism is bad in America, but I have never seen it so openly expressed as I did in China. She said, yet, materialism is a virtue in China because you're being responsible. You're taking care of your family. And so if the house that Solomon was talking about was not a physical temple or his physical palace, but he's talking about children, well, then that would make sense. He's talking about his family is a gift of the Lord from the children that arrive. And even if the house that he is referring to in the first two chapters is not his family, but rather a physical house of some sort, maybe God's temple or maybe his own personal house, well, you could still say he's working for his posterity. The temple was for the posterity of the Jews. So was his house. But at any rate, for whatever reason, the main point stands firm. Children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. That's just repeating the same thing. Now, interestingly, some translations have children are a gift of the Lord, and some translations have sons are a gift of the Lord. Here are some translations that use children are a gift of the Lord. The KJV, the American Standard Version, the Darby Version, God's Word, the New American Bible, and the New American Standard Bible. Now, here are some translations that use sons as the translation. Sons are a gift of the Lord. The Holman Christian Study Bible, the Bible in Basic English, and interestingly, the Young's Literal Translation, which says, lo, an inheritance of Jehovah are sons. Holman Christian Study Bible, and even the Bible in Basic English, which is a very simplified translation, modern translation, has sons. And the literal Hebrew, obviously, is sons because of the Young's Literal Translation. I don't know Hebrew enough to know why there's a difference here. It could be sons because there's a masculine reference in verse 4, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. That's sort of a masculine reference. You usually don't think of little girls, your daughters, as arrows being shot at people. So I can see that. However, since all the old translations have children and a lot of the modern translations have children, I think we can go with that because it is true that little girls, your daughters, are gifts of the Lord. I've got two of them, and they are absolutely two of the most valuable gifts I've ever had from God. So we include girls here. Sons and daughters are a gift of the Lord. And sons, by the way, can mean descendants. And descendants, of course, include the distaff side of the human race. So children are a gift of the Lord. Verse 4, they're like arrows in the hand of a warrior. What's the point of this metaphor? Well, an arrow projects great strength. It can do a lot of damage from a long way off. They do the job they are meant to do. And so the point of verse 4 is that each child will be a defense and support of his family. Now, it's easy to focus on the number of the arrows as the point of the metaphor. Verse 5 says, the man's quiver is full of them. But we should also focus on the strength of the arrows, the tremendous damage an arrow can do when shot. Those arrows, those children, can protect you in your old age. They can protect you from your enemies. As verse 5 says, how blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. So the idea is Strong family will help you against your enemies. And I think that's absolutely true. It's sad when you see people that don't have family members around them to help them. I just heard of a missionary to Indonesia, 30-something-year-old woman with her husband. She has a stillborn baby, and there was no family around her because she was in Indonesia and not in America. How horrible it was during the COVID-19 pandemic. How many people died and their loved ones weren't able to even talk to them because of these lockdown lunatics who panicked because of the virus that has a 99% survival rate, and they caused all that human suffering by not letting people see their loved ones as they pass. But at any rate, family is extremely important. Children are extremely important. And once again, this is the great antidote to the anti-children culture that we live in today. People don't want to get married. Men are openly proclaiming their celibacy on YouTube channels because women are feminists, B-I-T-C-H-E-S, which is basically true today in our secular culture. They blame men for everything. They squeal. They won't cook. They talk about their careers and the heck with their husband's careers, and men just say, well, why do I want to put up with that? And so they don't get married. Well, how are you going to have children? Well, let's have them out of wedlock. Well, let's have them out of wedlock, they say. I follow the NBA. I'm thinking about quitting, but one of my favorite teams has a member on it that had a sexual situation that was so complicated I couldn't even keep track of it. And the kids are all screwed up. They might have half brothers and sisters from 4 or 5 different marriages. The family is important, and our culture does not know how to support the family. We know how to pretend that men can marry men. I just saw an article about a conservative, a politically conservative commentator who was in charge of one of America's greatest right-wing blogs, who married his boyfriend, and the Yahoo article that described the marriage described the suit that the so-called bride or groom, whatever they call him, was wearing, just as if he were a bride, just as if the journalist was describing the bride's dress, as is commonly done. This is perversion, and these are conservatives. These are not the leftist lunatics who now control our culture and our universities. There's a lot fighting against the family. And Christians, their number one duty is to keep their family intact, strong, and serving God. And by the way, the hand that rocks the cradle controls the world. That's absolutely true. And all women, Christian women out there who are doing their best to raise their family, you have the greatest ministry in the world. And it's real easy to forget that because the culture and sometimes the church does not give you the affirmation that you so sorely need. In verse 5, the blessed man whose quiver is full of children will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. What gate? Well, it could be the gates of the city where all the business of the city is carried out and there are lawsuits carried out in the gates of the city, and the man might have legal adversaries. I don't know why children would particularly help him there. Adam Clark suggests rather that the gate that Solomon is referring to is robbers violating the gate of the house. The more children one has, the more people there will be to oppose the forceful entry of the robbers. I like that solution, that suggestion by Clark. And so this psalm, as most psalms do, end on a very positive note about the importance of the family. And so we are finished with Psalms 127 and are now prepared to go in our next audio to Psalms 128. I will entitle that psalm, Blessed is Everyone Who Fears the Lord. I hope you stay tuned with me, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.